And once again, I'll tell you, you are tuned to KPFA or KPFB in Berkeley or 88.1 KFCF in Fresno or online at kpfa.org. My name is David Ganz. The program is Dead to the World. It is ordinarily a music program, but tonight we are listening to an interview with a true legend of American Earth People culture, Owsley Stanley, also known as Bear. He's the namesake of Bear's Choice, an album of Grateful Dead music. He recorded the Grateful Dead because he was their sound man. He was doing monitors. As you'll hear, he started with the Grateful Dead in 1966 and brought his huge home stereo system down to the Fillmore and wound up being the Grateful Dead sound man for many years, and also inspired and designed many, many, many audio tools that have made all of us able to hear music better. The famous legendary Wall of Sound system that the Grateful Dead toured with in 1974 was a huge breakthrough, and is a little too expensive to actually use for too long, but it was an amazing tool. Many, many other ideas, as you'll hear. Plus, the guy just had an incredible mind, as you've heard, and as many callers have called in to say, you know, they wanted to know who I was talking to here. Again, it was Owsley Stanley, who died on March 13th in a car crash in Australia, where he'd been living for the last 20 years or so, at the age of 76, and, I consider it a great personal loss. I knew him and hung out with him some, and got to benefit from his great wisdom and his crazy mind many times. And it's a great loss to the Grateful Dead and lots of other musicians and people in the audio community who worked with him and knew him. We'll get back to some more of the interview with Owsley in a few minutes. First, I want to tell you a couple things. First of all, I have some tickets to give away to screenings of the Grateful Dead movie. This is happening nationwide on April 20th. Consult your local listings for theaters. I've been given tickets to several theaters here in the Bay Area. The Bay Street 16 in Emeryville, Pleasant Hill Downtown 16 in Pleasant Hill, Walnut Creek in Walnut Creek 14 on Locust Street in Walnut Creek, Century Theaters in Hayward on Foothill Boulevard, the Black Hawk in Danville, and the Hacienda Crossings 20 in Dublin, California. If you are near any of those movie theaters and you'd like a pair of free passes to see the Grateful Dead movie on April 20th, call me at 510-848-4425, and I will take your mailing address and send you a pair of passes. I won't get to all of them this evening. I will give away some more passes next week, but once again, I want you to understand the Grateful Dead movie and terrific film document is playing in theaters on April 20th from coast to coast, and it's going to be accompanied by interviews that I believe were shot for the movie back in 1974 with Jerry Garcia and Bob Weir. These have never been seen before except, I guess, the excerpts that are in the film. And once again, the theaters are in Emeryville, Pleasant Hill, Hayward, Walnut Creek, Dublin, and Danville. I'm guessing these are the theaters that the KFOG ticket giveaway didn't cover. So if you're on the line already, hold on. As soon as I restart the Bear interview, I will start answering calls and taking down mailing addresses. If you don't get through, be patient. You might also send me email. This might also help. Send me email, david@gdhour.com, gdhour.com. If you'd like to go to one of those screenings, send me your mailing address to that email address, and I will take phone calls and emails until I have given away all of the free passes to the screenings of the Grateful Dead movie. Now, before we get on, I want to tell you about some events. There's a benefit for the Ashkenaz happening at the Ashkenaz this Friday, April Fool's Day. It's a community benefit, Night of the Fools, with Sean Hodge and High Beat, JB3, and Mana Maddie and the Family. Amazingly rockin' bay bands. The first monthly community benefit night to raise money for Ashkenaz. Now I completely support that cause. I was on the board of trustees of the Ashkenaz when we converted it to a nonprofit to keep it alive following the murder of founder David Nadel. So it sounds like a lot of great music, and it's a benefit for the Ashkenaz. Night of the Fools with Sean Hodge and High Beat, JB3 and Mana Maddie and the Family. That's this Friday, April Fool's Day. The Thugs, Tribal Hippie Underground Zone, are doing their monthly Dead Dance next Wednesday, April 6th, at the Hop Monk Tavern in Sebastopol, and they will have a very special guest. The wonderful Banana, Lowell Levenger, is going to sit in with them and do some songs with Thugs. Dark Star Orchestra is coming to town Thursday through Saturday, April 7th, 8th, and 9th, at the Great American Music Hall. The Mother Hips with Nikki Bloom opening Friday, April 8th at the Crystal Bay Casino in Crystal Bay, Nevada, and Saturday, April 9th at the Hop Monk Tavern in Sebastopol. Come in, Deb. It's okay. Daryl Anger and Scott Law will be performing on Saturday, April 9th at the Petaluma Church Concerts at the First Church of Christ Scientist at B and 6th in downtown Petaluma. Karen Armstrong is going to do a live recording session at the Freight and Salvage with the great, great Joe Craven and Joshua Zucker joining her. Karen Armstrong at the Freight and Salvage on Sunday, April 10th. And I think, well, that's probably enough listings for the near future here. Once again, I'm going to give away tickets to the Grateful Dead movie April 20th from coast to coast. It'll be showing in screens everywhere. And I'm really looking forward to seeing it on the big screen with big sound with a big crowd again. That's going to be great. And let's get back to the interview with Owsley Stanley, recorded on in January of 1991.
We were on the beach. Oh, the music scared you.
That's right.
I thought, these guys are fantastic. But it was scary. The music was scary. Pushed me to the edge, and I thought, the sound of Garcia's guitar was like the claws of a tiger. It was like, dangerously scary. Very, very to the point. They can't talk about this stuff. I thought to myself, one of these days, these guys are going to be greater than the Beatles someday. It wasn't as though I just thought that. It was almost like a revelation, like looking into the future. I just instinctively knew that there was something
they were going to make
like
it
that.
Big time.
Yeah, that was like not even that I actually thought about it in those terms, but I did think these guys are going to be greater than the Beatles.
It made it that.
That was the way the thought. That was the way I recognized the thought I was having about it. I mean, that was the terms in which that I sub-vocalized that to myself. And in a way, they are, because the Beatles were a phenomenon that was a phenomenon of the universal attractiveness of their music and the intense teenage involvement. You find that intense teenage involvement in dozens of different bands, and you find excellent musical output in dozens of different bands. They create a lot of fans. They have not created the kind of thing that's associated with the
culture.
It's different. It's a totally different thing.
It's so different
that there's a university professor in North Carolina that is studying them as a specific
phenomenon.
Yeah. So what did you do with that?
They played for a while, and then they did, and they played again, and all these other things were going on, and then there was this one paranoid little sucker in there, and he thought something, and I picked up his thought, because we were all linked together. It was this total telepathic loop, which meant that it was like being in a very noisy cocktail party inside your head.
Uh-huh.
This guy saw somebody come into the place that he thought was a narc. He thought narcs. I thought, narcs. And I went right out the side door. I was gone. So I
guess it wasn't illegal yet, was it?
There was all kinds of drugs going on there. It didn't matter. It was just this guy's paranoia came on my party line, and out I went. So, I mean, I don't think I was in the thing about me pushing the chair around was maybe, 10 or 15 minutes.
Wow, it's just somebody else's
and I saw one set of the Grateful Dead and some other stuff, and I was gone. I was out. I was running up the road.
But you went to see them again.
Oh yeah, but it was a while. That was so freaky. The whole trip was so freaky that that I thought they were messing with something that was probably very dangerous, is what I thought. This is not so good.
Well, wait, not so good? They were going to be bigger than the Beatles. This is not so good.
That was them. That was my. That was me standing in the room listening to them play their set.
Uh-huh.
I thought that, right? And then, but then the all the rest of the... Then I went into... I went on a cosmic trip into other chambers of the universe and for the rest of that night. And then the next day or a few days later, I talked to Kesey. I says, hey, you know, you're messing with stuff from ancient stuff, right? This is, and without any maps, we're... This maybe not. Maybe need to be careful about this. It was kind of scary. He kind of laughed at me. Well, it's sort of like the guy that gets on a roller coaster for the first time. Supposing some guy was a Yanomami Indian or something, right? And he comes out of the forest. And the first thing he does, somebody puts him on a roller coaster, right? He's never even seen civilization. Somebody puts him on a roller coaster.
He's going to go back and say, boy, civilization.
No. What it is that you'll get off that thing and say, that's very dangerous. That's scary, right?
Oh, I see.
And yet other people go round and round again and again and again.
It wasn't the Grateful Dead. It was the linkage, the prankster thing.
Which the Grateful Dead were part of. I mean, Grateful Dead were right. Pranksters.
Right.
They were musicians. They were also pranksters. It was like, the next time I saw them was at the Fillmore Acid Test, and I met Phil, and I walked over to him and I said, I'd like to work for you guys, because I had decided that that this was the most amazing thing I'd ever run into. But he says, we don't have a manager. I said, I don't think I want to be a manager. He said, well, we don't have a sound man. And I said, well, I don't know anything about that either, but I guess I could probably learn. Sounds more like more fun. And that's how that happened. And for a long time, it was like, no matter whatever else we were doing, we had to be at the acid test every week. That was it. As part of it is totally committed part of it. No matter what other shows we did or anything else, Saturday night, we were there.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, I don't know how many of those I would have gone to. I didn't actually think of myself as a prankster per se. I found it all kind of scary, and I found it all... Every time it provided days and days and days of sorting it out, putting it together, trying to get it together. It was sort of like a crash course in how to become a jet pilot when you had never seen a jet before. And the way they did it was they dropped you in there, took you up and said, the controls are yours! Whoa! Barrel rolls! Immelmans! You know, tail spins right into the ground sometimes. And but psychically, you recover from all those. I guess if you're tough, and I guess most of us were, occasionally some people weren't. It's unfortunate, but because of the way in which it was undertaken in those days, and the fact that we used to take huge amounts of acid. We used to take, 250, 300 mics or more. Kesey preferred 400 or more. And Albert Hoffman told me that was a substantial overdose. I says, yes, in retrospect, we realize it was. But
what do you consider an optimum dose?
Oh, I don't know. People nowadays seem to take around 100 or 150, something like that. All I know is that the result is that people, it's like first you have training wheels on your bike before you get the 1,000cc Yamaha, mm-hmm. It's a little different effect, and the result is that people don't get so crazy, I guess. But in those days, everybody got kind of crazy, and some people crash landed, and other people managed to make it further down the road. But the whole scene became very, very, very loud and very weird. It attracted a lot of attention. It attracted a lot of social concern because a lot of people were experimenting with radically different social matrices which were not, which were frightening to the, our cultural leaders and societal leaders, you know, the police, the legislatures, and all the people who, the business community, basically the people who are concerned with maintaining a stable society, saw this as a very threatening and frightening phenomenon. There's a lot of people acting very weird, doing things that just didn't fit, and they passed a lot of laws against it and tried to suppress it in various ways. Whether or not the psychedelics would have been included in the basic matrix of anti-drug laws or not, without the heavy influence of some people like Bart Linkletter, I doubt.
Right.
He was very
made up that myth about his daughter suicide.
Yeah.
That was a myth.
Yeah.
Well, she did throw herself out a window, but, you know, it was very convenient.
I heard that she was not on it, but just the fact that she had been taking it.
Right.
Was it not?
You're right.
Somewhere in the past, before she did it, she had taken it.
No, there were a lot of bogus stories.
Several other people did things like that.
People went blind staring at the sun stories. I remember those, right?
Yeah.
Santa Barbara, 1966. I do remember all
those. Chromosome damage.
Yeah, see, now there were scientists ready to cough up all this crap to suit the political agenda. Well, we still see that.
But some people do. So the thing about crashing into the walls, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sure, we were taking large doses because that's what we thought was the right amount. And some people were psychically crashing into walls.
Yeah.
And when nobody knew about it. We didn't come with a shaman, with a 1,000 years or 10,000 years or 100,000 years of traditions. And the ring of people holding your hand to show you the right way to go. It's not something that you started at puberty with. It's something all of a sudden, bang, you're shot from a cannon. And some people had a little problem with it. And so some people did themselves in when they weren't on it. Some people accidentally died when they were on it. Some people, I can't justify that stuff. You know, I didn't know any more than anyone else, right? All I knew was that it was better to take a known substance in a known quantity than an unknown mixture of who knows what at God knows what quantity. That was the only difference. And as far as I was concerned, I didn't advocate. I didn't tell anybody go out and take it, you know, or anything else. But I knew I wanted to. I knew it was important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was important. And I didn't want to poison myself. I didn't like Russian roulette with chemicals. And I didn't think it was appropriate.
So I would say then that what you were doing was essentially taking responsibility for it.
Yeah.
For yourself and for the people that you were experimenting with.
Yeah.
Your partners.
You might say.
Well,
it's one way of looking at it. It was all a matter of consent at that point.
Yeah.
But the fact is that out in the culture as a whole, all kinds of bizarre things were happening. And in fact, it bothered me.
So, give me an example. What do you mean?
Well, I see. I didn't know for a long time whether it was a good thing or a bad thing. Eventually, I realized that the thing itself was neither good nor bad.
What, acid?
Yeah.
The acid culture?
Well, psychedelic itself was neither good nor bad, any more than a very sharp knife is good or bad, right?
Right.
You use the knife to...
Depends on how you use it.
It's a tool.
Whittle a sculpture. You can use it to trim your nails, you can use it to cut up your food, or you can use it to stab somebody. So the knife itself is not the operative thing there. But it took me a long time because of the fact that it's so powerful and changes consciousness so much.
So you thought it was an intrinsically good thing at first?
I didn't know. And that
because
was the reason why I cycled in and out of it for a long time. And eventually I decided that it was getting... We're just getting too weird to handle. And
well, then I would say that acid upset your moral construct.
So it made me think about it very seriously. Because of the fact that things happened that weren't positive, that non-positive things were happening as well as positive ones.
Mm-hmm.
Things like the example about the girl that jumped out the window and Charles Manson.
Yeah.
And the fact that one person would take acid and become like Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
And another person would take acid like some of the Hell's Angels and say, oh, man, I love to get in a fight when I'm on acid. Why? Because everybody else is in slow motion. Right. Well, then Kesey said, hey, all this does is turn up your volume. The basic nature of the person is simply amplified.
Right. Right.
Well, in a social context, you can understand how those who are... who feel responsible for the social matrix itself don't want something that may produce these kind of effects.
Once again, you're listening to an interview with Owsley Stanley, a.k.a. The Bear, an amazing character, as everybody who's called in has observed, with a lot of tremendous things to say. He passed away in a car accident at the age of 76 on March 13th in Australia, which had been his adopted home for several years. This interview was originally recorded in January of 1991, and most of it appeared in my book, Conversations with the Dead, which is still available mostly, I think, as an e-book. You can get it from Amazon. Anyway, let's continue with the interview.
You were asking me, basically, how you thought the Grateful Dead scene related to psychedelics. I don't know how it relates to psychedelics. All I know is that at one point, I joined up with a band that were pranksters, that were part of a scene that was doing something that was right out on the edge of consciousness, the edge of social, the edge of magic, the edge of music, that was very dynamic. A band composed of five guys that were amongst the smartest people I'd ever run across. To find that many really smart people that were, that minds operated in the same function zone that mine did, that was absolutely could carry on the most tenuous and stratospheric conversations with nobody getting lost. Mm-hmm. That blew my mind, number one. Uh-huh. It's unusual to find that kind of a bunch. I've worked for a lot of bands. I've been on the road. I've worked in halls where they come through a different band every day. In festival situations, I've worked in situations where I've had a lot of contact with a lot of musicians. Uh-huh. And by and large, I find there's a great many really bright guys involved in the music scene.
Yeah,
but
really
to find that many all in one group is truly unique.
Now that prankster scene didn't sustain that much longer.
It was sort of like, if you set fire to a skyrocket, it's going to be brilliant as hell, but it don't go very far and it don't last very long. Uh-huh. It attracted so much social pressure on the individuals that it had it not been for, Kesey getting busted and all these other things happening, mm-hmm. and the intense amount of social police pressure on it, that it, who knows how far or where it would have gone. But as it was, it did its thing ultra spectacularly, but it was by necessity, it had to follow that old prankster saying, nothing lasts.
Right. Huh.
It lasted as long as it did, and then that was it. Even in the beginning, there was a great reluctance to get weird at regular shows. There was no reluctance to get weird at the acid test, because they said, if they can't play, it doesn't matter. If they don't play well, it don't matter, because nobody's paying to see them. It's not a matter of having an audience that you're performing for. It's just a big party. But they had to be at the party. They were an essential part of the party in their minds. That was an essential thing that had to be done every Saturday night, uh-huh. which I found not to my liking at first, because, it was just a little too weird and a little too heavy, and it was hard to control, and it looked like too much exposure and made too much heat, and I don't know, all those things. I was not a real loud thing at that point, and I didn't want to be a loud thing or attract a lot of attention for any reason. Uh-huh. And here was this scene that was so loud that if you put it on the moon, it would attract attention, right? So I was thinking that maybe, and here was this band of incredible musicians making this magic music, which I thought was more important to do that than to do this other crazy thing.
So you were sort of an impetus toward professionalism at that point?
I've always been that. In the old days, you went to a show, and there was no spotlights on the band. Mm-hmm. There was a light show, and there was a lot of other stuff going on, and it was like a huge party anyway. And the band never were flashy dressers or anything, and they never sought being in the floodlights or with footlights or anything. It wasn't like that. It was the music.
Yeah.
And I don't believe that there was ever a time that the band wasn't more concerned about playing music. people who go and say this, that, and the other about the Grateful Dead show are people that can't hear the music. The music to them sounds like it's meandering, or it sounds like it doesn't have a center or a focus or anything else. Well, true, from time to time it doesn't. But on many levels, it always has something happening. There's always a level at which it is happening. Mm-hmm. The thing is that some more straight people that go and sit down at the show, if the show isn't one of those dynamic, tight events, which maybe one out of four or five is, totally, if it has any moments of musical misshapenness or elaborate bridges or just heavy sections that are jazz-like but never quite gel and focus, which sometimes happens because any improvisational music will have that, you know. Mm-hmm. I've even heard Keith Jarrett get into those kind of bags where he'll go meandering off somewhere and it just doesn't come back to where you might like to see it come. It goes on sometimes to gel, sometimes it doesn't. I think that influence in the music tends to make it that way. And if you've got somebody going to see something like that that's not jazz-oriented or cannot really hear the kind of musical ideas that are going on, won't know. And they'll say, they're all over the place and this, that, and the other, no focus and no direction, all that. You hear that all the time.
And that, of course, that dilutes the gestalt energy in the building.
I don't think so.
You don't?
Those people, gestalts do not always... are not always composed of everyone.
No, I'm
they
not
can be
saying
composed of more or less.
Part, but the more dissipation of that stuff there is, the less. I mean, the more unanimity, the better. I would tend to think. Would you?
No.
No, I wouldn't. No.
No, I think in fact the presence of every kind of person, the presence of every different level of engagement and disengagement, mm-hmm. Is more important.
I'll go along with that.
It's like a reaction vessel that has all of the pieces of whatever can be made. And it makes something. But it doesn't use all of the pieces all the time.
Is the idea that your most distracted person can suddenly snap too, right? Isn't that one of the things that you would want to see happen in that realm? That all of a sudden the music finds its focus and all of a sudden the wandering minds find their focus as well. I mean, that's one of those fun things about Grateful Dead, is hauling somebody in there as unsuspecting, watching them get it.
Sometimes they do. But then it's like a sculpture.
Yeah.
If you look at a sculpture, what you're looking at is the surface.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what's inside it.
Yeah.
But there's more inside than there is surface.
Yeah.
So most of what a sculpture is, when you look at it, is indeterminate. It could be nothing. Or it could be something. Or it could be another sculpture. Or dozens of sculptures. Or just random noise. Because all you perceive in the sculpture is the form itself, not the substance within. And the thing that you're talking about, that gestalt consciousness, is also like that. In fact, I have a strong tendency to use sculptural viewpoints in most things. And for instance, when I'm working with sound, I work with sound in a three-dimensional fashion, which to me is palpably three-dimensional. I do that in the way in which I set up stage miking for a live show, the way in which I orient speakers, the kinds of electrical things that I do to the sound. And to me, it is physical. And you can walk through the hall and feel its shape and change. For instance, you experience a certain spatial form, dimensionality, if you listen to Olden in the Way with a set of headphones or something. Even with speakers, they move around the room. You seem to be moving around the stage. It changes as you move around. It's valid, but it's like you'll be one time you'll be on one side, one time you'll be on another side, sometime you'll be in the middle of it. It's always coherent. It's always three-dimensional, but the spatial image changes. Your perception of it changes, but it seems palpable. It seems mm-hmm. real, like a sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
It's the way I look at sounds. It flashes back to that time when I saw the sound coming out of the speakers.
I understood that just from reading the copy on the back of the Olden and the Way album. Understood what you said in there about that was that, you know, if you mic it properly, all that stuff will happen. You know, you don't need discrete tracks and all that stuff.
That's right.
I mean, I didn't understand the technology behind it, and maybe I still don't, but I've always understood that, and I've always believed that if you put your mics up in the right place, you will get something more than discrete miking and stuff will get you. I mean, but that's a bluegrass band always mixes itself.
Well, that helps. Yeah. It helps because they move in and out of the mics and around the mics. But it took me 6 months to figure out what to do with the mics to make that happen. A lot of listening, a lot of thinking, a lot of understanding, a lot of playing them back. We're talking about something that happened 19 years ago.
Right.
And I can do a totally different thing now because I know more about mics and more about other things, but I still only use two tracks.
Right. I think that's the point. That you still don't need more than
you
two
don't need
tracks
more than
if
two.
You do it right. But let's go back to where we
because
were. Work up to
every, because the way in which your ears work, you've only got two ears. And it's the shape of the ear changes, but you can detect all kinds of different things with the information from two auditory sensing units, one on each side of your head. Those two units create a totally three-dimensional space in your mind. And that three-dimensional space, which is created from your senses, is as illusory as the reality of the sound. But what your ears do is they tap into the total matrix of what is in the room. All of the energy that's in the room, whether it's bouncing off a wall or coming from the speaker or whatever, enters your ears. And inside, your brain sorts it out. Because of the fact that humans use language as the single most important survival tool they have. Our mouths are modified for it. Our ears, our brains are modified for it. Our brain does a tremendous amount. I hear a lot of stuff. I watched a TV program called Cats, Caressing the Tiger, where they were talking about the ability of the cat to localize sound. And then I've read things about the dolphins and their use of sound, and the bats and their use of sound, and owls. Most owls hunt as much with their ears as they do with their eyes. In fact, the facial disc of a barn owl is extremely important. Owls' two ears are different sizes, different shapes, yes.
Different.
The feathers on one side of the head are different than the feathers on the other side. And I have something like that. When I was 19, I had a diving accident when I jumped off a high board where I was learning some clown dives from a bunch of Hawaiians that were in the military station in D.C. were coming to that pool that I was working as lifeguard.
Yeah.
They were teaching me these clown dives. And one of the clown dives, you go off and you go in on your side with your hand over your ear. But you put that up at the last minute and I missed.
Oops.
The water went in and almost shattered my eardrum. Didn't. But it caused a heavy hemorrhage which filled the entire inner ear with blood.
Uh-huh.
And there was no way to get it out. The doctor didn't want to cut the eardrum had taken out, aspirated. Maybe he should have, I don't know. But anyway, I guess it wasn't the way he did it. And antibiotics in those days were pretty primitive. The result is that by the time my body had absorbed that blood clot, some bacteria and mold together had established a culture in there. And the result of the culture was that it produced something sort of like arthritis. The three little bones that articulate together, mm-hmm. and it produced a kind of arthritis in those bones. There's nothing wrong with the eardrum. There's nothing wrong with the nerves. But the linkage between the eardrum and the nerves has to go through this bridge of bones, which the articulation of which was interfered with by the scar tissue caused by that infection. Result is that the two ears have a slightly different shape, mm-hmm. Response shape. So as far as my brain is concerned, there's absolutely no confusion about which ear is which, just like the owl with the two different shaped feather things and the different shaped ear holes gives them a totally different signal from the two sides of their heads, which allows them to pinpoint the mouse or whatever they're after very precisely.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at most animals that need a highly developed stereoscopic sense in their hearing, they have this unbalance between the two sides. And so man's ears are not normally that different. But due to this injury, it's a funny thing where a handicap becomes an advantage. Due to this injury and the psychedelics, which amplify everything, I was able to sort it all out. So I produced a sound picture where all the high-frequency stuff is actually coming from my left ear because the right ear above like 6,000 cycles isn't very sharp.
We're listening to an interview with the late, great Owsley Stanley, a.k.a. Bear, recorded on January 13th of 1991 and published in a book called Conversations with the Dead, which is available in used bookstores and also online for e-books and Kindles and all that stuff through Amazon and elsewhere. Conversations with the Dead is the name of the book. The subject of the interview is Owsley Stanley. The interviewer is me, David Gans. The date was January 13th, 1991. And let's listen to the last 20 minutes I have for you this evening.
Yeah, I knew nothing when I started. I just said, hey, sure, I'll be the sound man. And we can use my hi-fi. I didn't know anything about it. But I did notice one thing straight away. And that was that the instruments that they were using looked like somebody built them in their garage. When you opened them up, they looked like they had parts that looked like they came out of a 1932 radio. And in fact, it was about right. Yeah. It was about right. It was I think it was Les Paul who took apart a radio and put the parts in his guitar. And that's where it all started.
So you discovered
basically the guitars in 1966 were identical. They still had magnet with a coil of wire around it, six screws in the top of the magnet, and sometimes not even the screws, but often the screws. They had a wax capacitor and a cheap potentiometer. That was it. And crude, very crude. The wiring looked like the wiring I used to take out of old radios from World War II. And from old wooden house radios. The insides of those radios, the capacitors, the parts, the pots, the wires, everything looked the same as what you'd find in the back of a Gibson or a Fender or whatever. And the bodies themselves didn't seem to be all that well constructed. And I thought, well, hey, number one, the amplifiers and the instruments look like they're from pre-World War II, and here we are with a technology that is putting things in orbit around the Earth. And I thought, what has changed in the days of Bach? The highest technology that man could produce built the organs that he played. And here, the musicians, the equivalent of Bach, modern musicians that are writing and playing music, are forced to play with something that looks like it belongs to World War I, World War II period. Mm-hmm. This is wrong. But I'm not an engineer. I never was. So I thought, we got to do something about this. And so I started looking around for someone who could help. And I ran into this kid, Tim Scully. And he seemed to know about electronics. I thought, hey, I need somebody. You want to do it? He said, okay. So he was a bright kid, real bright. He knew enough about electronics, how to wire two or three parts together. All I knew basically was what I had learned to be an electronic technician in my Air Force period. Mm-hmm. I was a ham radio operator, and I knew something about the theory and operation of radios, and I'd worked as a broadcast technician, but I wasn't a design engineer, and I more or less understood how things work, and I knew how to solder stuff together so I could build things, but I didn't consider myself a design engineer in any way, shape, or form. I didn't really want to, but I knew we had to do something because the technology was so primitive that it seemed like it was holding the music back, that we could go to another level if we had better instruments. Half the time they'd crackle and pop and hum, and there would be distortion out of the speakers. It wouldn't be controllable, and the guys would make a sound not what they wanted, or... So we went wholly the other way, and we tried using hi-fi stuff. And hi-fi stuff, it turned out, wasn't heavy-duty enough. And the voices of the theater speakers weren't strong enough. And I went down with Tim. We went down and talked to the engineers at Altec Lansing. They weren't interested. They said, well, you want power here, use this driver. And that driver rolled off at 3,000 hertz. You want it to go higher. Well, we have this one. It goes to 9,000, and that one, but it would only take 2.5 watts. This one would take 50 watts, but it wouldn't go up. I said, no, we want one that's this powerful that'll go twice as far out as that. We want to go to 15,000. Well, you can't do that. We don't want to. We're not interested. Besides, we sell all the speakers we make anyway. Get lost. So we went as far as we could, and we tried and made all kinds of stuff, and even tried centralized. And eventually got to the point where in the fall of 66, it had grown like topsy into this thing, which was more of a problem. It required a separate pilot over there controlling things while the band was playing, which was unsatisfactory. It didn't always produce just the kind of sounds that it was supposed to, which was a problem. The musicians felt that it was like carrying a giant thing on there around with them all the time. It didn't work. And so one day we had this big meeting and they said, we can't do it. I said, okay, fine, no problem. Go over to the to Leo's and pick out whatever you think you would be right.
And go buy a regular piano.
Yeah. Go. No. All their amplifiers, everything. Their guitars all plugged into this box that Tim had
bought. Oh, I see.
Everything went into this box. And then out of the box it went into the amplifiers. Then it went into the speakers, right? But all went through this gadget.
Was it, what did I have in it? Buffers and switches and stuff?
Oh, I don't know. He built it. Uh-huh. I'm not the engineer. He was the engineer. He built it.
So everybody plugged into this box.
Nobody knew what to do.
Routed their signals to the other stuff.
Yeah, and it was,
which made them completely dependent on Scully.
They could control their stuff and some changes over there, but he was watching that. I was out in the front doing this and this. The whole thing just, and the thing was that nobody could define what it was that it had to do. The musicians themselves couldn't. They say, well, I play the guitar and I want to hear a sound. What kind of a sound? Well, yeah, this is the right sound. And the musicians couldn't talk about it. And I hadn't a clue. I just knew that what was too primitive. And Tim, he didn't have a clue as to what to do. So we were constantly changing things, wiring stuff, trying to find out how to make it do whatever it was that nobody could describe, that everybody in their own way knew, but nobody could communicate about it. It was not something that could be defined, right? So this was just like one of those dead ends that you go off along, right? So we went off along it. But it finally got to a point where it was just not working, and everybody sat down and they said, hey, it's not working. And I said, fine, I agree with you. I don't think it's working. And they said, we want to do something different. I said, fine, go to the music store and pick out what you want. And
so this is where you began being their patron?
And he says, and then what? I says, well, I'll buy all the stuff you have now for the amount of money it takes to buy all the stuff you need, right? So we'll make a trade. So they went and got all the stuff that they wanted, and I took all the stuff, and so then I went and sold it all off. And I sold some to the Straight Theater, some to Bill Graham, some to this, and some to that. So it all got sold. It all got gotten rid of. Some of it I gave away. A lot of it I gave away. Mm-hmm. But the point was is that by that time, of course, there was a lot of other things going on. For one thing, we'd learned how to improve some of the other kinds of amps. And we'd improve the physical instruments by putting high-quality components in them. Mm-hmm. Instead of $2.50 worth of parts, we put $25 worth of parts. That alone improved a lot of things. Uh-huh. And we'd learned how to make better chords and stuff. And lots of things had improved. But at that point, I went on off because it was something else I had to do. They went all off with this stuff and started playing. And one of the people that joined up with them at that point was Healy. And Healy is a very pragmatic kind of a guy who liked to tinker with stuff and fix stuff, right? Not that he was a design engineer, he wasn't, but he was a consummate troubleshooter. He could go into something that wasn't working and find out what wasn't working and fix it. And so he was fixing this sort of stuff, and he was, in his very pragmatic approach, led him to go and just rent a whole bunch of speakers. And he'd rent like four times as many drivers as he needed, right? So they'd blow everything up in the first set, and he'd pull off the blown-out part, put on another set, play the halfway through the second set, and he'd be taking them down, fixing them, putting them back. And the thing was that the rental companies, we get all this stuff back, and it'd be just blown to bits, right? Every time, he'd blown to bits, right? Uh-huh. And yet it was money they'd rent. They'd pay the price, they'd take the thing up, and they always came back blown up, right? And so they went down to Altec, and they were big enough, right? They were
so when Harry McCune went
down. Yeah, right,
there.
They went down to Altec and said, hey, man, hey, this is no good. Altec started working on the stuff, right? We couldn't do it. We went 2 years before, begged them to do it. Nobody would do it, right? As soon as it started to be dollar and cents, oh, well, we can rent this stuff, right? Rent it, blow it up, take it back. We don't have to worry about it. We can buy it and rent it next time. They raise the rental price a little bit, but they can't because they got to rent to all these guys that aren't blowing it up. They can't make a special price to you because you'll go to their competitor, which was what happened. There was two or three different rental companies, and so all this stuff was suddenly Altec was getting all, and JBL and all these guys were getting all this blown up stuff, right? So they had to make it. It was no longer a point of why improve it. People are buying as much as we make.
We put a
financial twist on it, right? We started tweaking their ass real hard because it was expensive to replace these. And so suddenly the big manufacturing concerns that had a monopoly on the sound market were suddenly forced into doing these things. And then I went through the whole thing, and in 1968... the Carousel Ballroom thing came together, and I was sound man at that place along with Bob Matthews, and I started tinkering with the little amplifiers, specifically a musician named Alvin Bishop asked me if I couldn't improve the sound in his little Princeton amp that he liked to play, but which wasn't very loud, and he had to constantly be mic'd the PA, and one time he played in there, and he said, "Well, you know, I wish it were louder, but I don't want a twin reverb because it's too much. I want this little guy."
Princeton
reverb. So I started taking it all apart and applying some rule of thumb principles and changing a few things and putting a different power supply and did a little hot rod trip on the output stage that I'd learned from working for a cheapo hi-fi company once. Back in the past, and did a few things to it, and it came out a screamer. They put a 12-inch speaker, but left the 10-inch hole in the front board, made a heavy-duty front board, and bolted it in there, so it choked it a little bit, and it turned it into a real screamer, man.
The thing
was
really cool. What's the principle there? Putting a 12-inch speaker on a 10-inch hole.
See if it works.
And it worked.
Yeah.
It did something.
Yeah.
Useful.
Yeah. It didn't sound good. It didn't sound as good if you made the hole big, because we tried that. Because the original boards were made out of chipboard, you know, that pressed wood fiber, which wouldn't hold the power of the speaker. So we always had to make a new board. So we made a new board. We tried it with a 12-inch hole, and we tried it with the regular hole that was originally on it. Because originally I just bolted the sucker in. I didn't do anything. I just bolted it in. And it only sounded good. It sounded best with the smaller hole. So.
How did you just accidentally do that? Or say, just what the let's try that to see?
I said, I didn't feel like taking a hole saw and cutting a hole out.
So
I
just
unbolted one speaker and bolted the other speaker in. You know, all I did is drill four holes for that. It was easy. Mm-hmm. And it worked.
And that's so.
It sounded good. Elvin liked the way it sounded. And that was that. And then I built one for Yarman, for Garcia, and a bunch of other people. A lot of people did it. I went up, we were for a while having a little sort of a production shop back at the Carousel. Hot rodding these speakers. I'd drill an extra hole in the front, put a middle control, so it had treble, middle, and bass. Because basically the thing is, the circuit's very similar to the one in the twin reverb. Just it had the small tubes, single small tubes, and this little speaker in it. But if you got the industrial versions of the tubes, and then I built a power supply that super filtered all the low stages and put raw AC on the plates, just practically raw, unfiltered. I used a choke input. That's with all the filtering it got. So I had the max. The choke went to the lower stages, to the screen grid, and to the lower stages in the amplifier. And the plates got the raw high voltage. Right? We replaced the little rectifier tube with diodes, and then that went directly into a cap. So it had max voltage. But no filtering, no resistors, no filtering. It just went right straight into the plate. So they had max voltage there, right? And then...
Which gave it more power?
It gave it max voltage, right, on the plate. Uh-huh. And the output power was dependent on the plate voltage.
Oh, okay.
But the control, the amplifying characteristics and the noise in there was controlled by the screen grid and by the lower stages. And those were well filtered because we ran it through a filter choke before it got to the screen grid.
And the choke is a coil.
Filtered choke's much better filter than a resistor. Mostly what was originally was in there is a series of resistors and capacitors.
But a choke is a coil, right?
A coil, yeah.
And it's just a very dense coil.
Well,
that
it's
does
a,
what?
It looks like a transformer. It's only got one winding instead of two. It looks like a little...
It's not inducing a voltage in another circuit.
It has to get through,
but it's doing what to it?
Doesn't let the AC component go through. It resists the flow of alternating current. And a filter choke, which is what that was, is a choke that's designed to filter the hum out of a power supply. It's designed for that.
Mm-hmm. But that's what a rectifier does also. It takes in AC and puts out DC.
Yeah, a rectifier is a one-way valve that lets the electricity through in one direction only.
Mm-hmm.
And you can produce a circuit, which is called a full-wave bridge, that lets through one half and then inverts and lets through the other half. So that it
produces, so you get the maximum power, but all in one
power thing. Out of both halves of the wave, but it goes to zero, so it's rough, it's bumpy. There's an AC ripple, as they call it, the hum. That's what the hum that you hear in an amplifier or something. That's that AC ripple getting through.
So the choke?
Chokes are expensive. Like, you have to pay like $6 or $7. Most manufacturers stick a bunch of resistors in there, which cost 20 cents. And it's a, you know, it's a 5 watt or 10 watt. And you put a series of resistors with capacitors. But the resistor resists the AC and the DC component. It shows no discrimination. And so you're depending upon the capacitors to short the AC to the ground.
Okay.
And the resistor gives them something to work against.
Right.
And you can actually compute a time factor if you want, but usually use great big caps and small resistors.
Okay.
But by using one choke coil in there, the voltage doesn't drop much going through it because it doesn't have as much resistance in it as the resistor would have. So you're keeping your voltage up and you're blocking the most of the AC, and you got a big cap on the front of it anyway, because it's not a swinging choke, it's a filtering choke.
Mm-hmm.
And that big cap is directly feeding the plates. So the plates have got the full peak-to-peak voltage that's coming out of the power supply, which in this case was like 400 volts or something instead of 360. It was like 420 or something like that. But it's real rough because it's still got a lot of ripple on it. But the ripple doesn't matter because it's a push-pull circuit. And the amplification is controlled by the screen. And the screen was filtered on with this choke on it. So it was super smooth. So it was a dead quiet amplifier with he still had the same little basic tubes, except we used the military version of the tube.
Okay, right. I remember that stuff.
7508s instead of 6V6s. So it was a military. So it was a rugged tube that could take all the abuse in a big speaker in a small box. It would shake itself to pieces. We used military versions for all the tubes in it.
So you immediately reduced the headache factor at these gigs, I'd imagine, considerably, right?
Well, the whole idea was to try to bring the equipment, which is basically pre-war design. It was vacuum tubes. It was, you know, we'd open up one of those things, it'd be full of wax capacitors.
Right.
We'd pull all those things out and put modern mylars and
take apart old TV chassis.
Yeah. Well, you get an old early TV and it looked just like the inside of a Fender right from the factory.
Right.
So right for one thing, Garcia would be playing twin reverbs, and all of a sudden the tubes would go red hot and the bridge would melt out. The tubes would melt down,
mm-hmm.
blow the tubes out totally. Right. There's four of these big tubes in there, and they were not cheap.
These were the output tubes?
These were the output tubes. They just all turn red hot and go, just like that, bang. Right? And we take the amplifier and test it. Couldn't find it was wrong, right? And eventually, I think it was Wickersham or someone, managed to put some clips on there. Or it might have been Keeley, I don't know. But somewhere along the line, someone tested the thing right at the moment of failure. So what happened was these factory-supplied capacitors were like 600-volt caps, and it went between the plate of the driver tube and the grid of the output tube. So they were the driver that blocked the plate voltage off the grid. And the voltage on the driver tubes was something like 360 volts. And so 600 volts is it's almost twice the voltage you'd expect it to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But what we discovered was the way the guitar was being played, the way Garcia was playing it, was producing voltage spikes that were running upwards of 700 or 800 volts.
Uh-huh.
They'd punch a hole in the capacitor, which would put the full plate voltage of the driving stage directly on the grid, driving it to 300 volts positive.
Instant meltdown.
Yeah, it would... it momentarily was short. But as soon as that had happened and you turned the thing off, it would heal. And it would...
Oh, so that's what happens when you exceed the voltage rating of the capacitor, is it just passes it straight through?
No, it just happened that these intense spikes would weaken, it would be a weak place somewhere in it, not always, sometimes. It would be a weak place, it would pierce through, the voltage spike would go through, blow the output tubes off, you shut the amp down, turn it back on, it's fine, because the capacitor would heal, right? We found out that if you put 800 volt ones in there, then it was a long time between failures. And if you put 1,000 or 1,600 volts in there, no more problems. 1,600 volts never failed. Thousands might fail. 800s would take a long time to fail, and 600s would forget it. We tried to tell Fender about that, you know?
Uh-huh.
He says, we never heard of it.
Okay, one last segment here with Owsley Stanley, a.k.a. Bear. This is all about the technical issues of the Grateful Dead at Woodstock.
You were asking me, basically, how you thought the Grateful Dead scene related to psychedelics. I don't know.
Wrong hit. It's this one.
I mean, I chased down and pulled ground loops out of every radio station I worked for. Every single one had ground loops in it. And so if you can get rid of radio frequency ground loops, hey, audio's a cinch. So right from the get-go with the Dead, we get rid of all that stuff. It was very rare. The only time that we had a serious problem was at Woodstock. And the reason we had a problem at Woodstock was that the transmitter that they were using for the radio signal for their helicopters was grounded in one place, and the stage was grounded in another place. There were two ground rods driven to the ground, and it was separate.
Uh-huh.
The result was that the ground system on the stage was not the same ground potential that the transmitter was at.
Uh-huh.
So all of the equipment on the stage was acting as a supplemental antenna, receiving the signal from the... And it was in everything. It was worst of all in Phil's bass. For some reason, it really focused in on Phil's bass. And we were going nuts trying to figure it out because it had been going on all the time. Every band that played, it was having this problem.
And you were the only ones that stopped and with it, right?
Well, I got the house electrician, and we started searching. And we found that the two ground rods, and I said, that's it. So we pulled the ground connection off from the stage, off that rod, ran it over the other side of the stage, and clipped it on to the same rod that the transmitter was going into it. That was it. Gone. History.
How long did it take you to find that out?
About 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Then what was the interminable delay at Woodstock?
There was a lot of delays. You know what the relay was? The guys who had set this thing up had this idea. They had these half cookies, big half cookies. They were like 20 feet or 25 feet. It was like a circle, big circle, 25 feet in diameter, made out of plywood. With 2x4s underneath that was split down the middle into two cookies, half pieces, with casters underneath them.
Right.
And they'd set a band up on a half cookie. And then they set another band up back to back on the half cookie. Right. And they for the set changes, they'd rotate this thing around like a wheel. And then pull one off and slide another half cookie over with another band. That way they could set them up over on the side. They had like three or four of these cookies, right?
So you're loading one in, one was performing, and one was loading out.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
So, right, exactly. So there was no problems with the setup.
Brilliant idea, but...
But, Ramrod and I took one look at that, and we said to the guy, that ain't going to work. Yes, it is. No, you don't understand. Our gear is so heavy that will break. You can't put the Grateful Dead on one of those cookies. You've got to go on the cookie. We're telling you, it's going to be a mistake. It's going to be much simpler. Let us set up behind these guys, take them off, and then the other one can come in. We'll take it off. We'll move it as fast. We can get a couple of other crews. We got plenty of people. No, no, you've got to go on the cookie. I'm telling you, it's a mistake. You got to go on the cookie. Okay. So we set up on the cookie, right? We set up on the cookies. Sure enough, the thing had rotated 10 degrees and all the casters went wham. 10 degrees, wham. So not only that, now we had to set, we had to do all of this while people were waiting because the other band, they could shove their cookie off, but there we were. There was no way, it was too heavy. No, the whole crew on it couldn't move it. We had to just take them off and move them. Had to do the whole setup. That was the delay. We tried to tell them. It might be a little longer, but not a lot longer. But because they could have shoved the other cookie out of the way, we'd been set up. We'd set up the drums. The whole thing would have worked. They wouldn't go for it.
That's all we have time for tonight. That's you've been listening to an interview with the late, great Owsley Stanley, a.k.a. Bear. His website, which had a lot of his essays and articles and thoughts on all sorts of things. And as you can tell, the man had a lot of ideas about a lot of things. His website is thebear.org. You'll also find some stuff about him on Wikipedia. And that's it for me. It's time for Larry Kelp and his program Sing Out. I will see you next Wednesday evening at 8 here on Dead to the World. And please stay tuned for Sing Out.